This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is Dick Cheney losing his clout? Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In Panama today, President Bush said, "We have an obligation to protect the American people in the war on terror, but we do not torture." This despite Vice President Cheney's effort to exempt the CIA from a Senate resolution requiring U.S. interrogators to stick to the Geneva Conventions. News reports say there is growing resistance to Cheney's stand from the State Department, the Pentagon, and even the West Wing. On To the Point, should interrogators be free to use any means necessary when American lives are at stake? Will a weakened vice president mean a loss of executive power for the Bush White House? On Reporter's Notebook later on, will the IRS crack down on liberal Episcopalians? First the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. Scooter Libby's indictment, bad news from Iraq, and resistance to a hard line on the treatment of prisoners all mean trouble for Dick Cheney. On To the Point, is the most powerful vice president in recent history losing his clout? On Reporter's Notebook, the IRS threatens liberal Episcopalians with the loss of their tax-exempt status. First, this news update, all of France is braced for a 12th night of the rioting that has killed one man and injured 36 policemen. Officials say there must be a restoration of order before they address the grievances of young Muslims. John Carreyrou is reporting from Paris for the Wall Street Journal. And John, thanks very much for being with us.
No problem.
What do we expect from the French government as the prime minister prepares to announce a plan to deal with these issues?
Yes, the prime minister, Dominique de Villepin, is going on TV on the evening news and is expected to put forth a plan that would have two planks. One is a security plank and the other is a social plank meant to address the deeper causes of this unrest. It's unclear what exactly the prime minister is going to propose security-wise and law enforcement-wise that will be new. In recent days, the French police has been using a helicopter, and the helicopter has flown over the Paris suburbs and with a big flashlight and tried to help the police on the ground track down small bands of very mobile youths who are responsible for most of the violence. But other than that, it's the riot police that France has been using hasn't been very effective in capturing these bands of youths and then stopping the violence. So serious questions are being raised about the French law enforcement system, which depends entirely on the state, is very centralized, and it just seems to not be coping very well with the situation.
I understand one of the aspects of this is that although they have been shot at, the police have not shot back.
That's true. I think there's clearly a major concern on the part of the government that if police were to shoot with live bullets and that if something were to happen, if one of these youths were to die, that it would further inflame the situation and that then things could really get out of control. So far, there has only been one death, and that was reported today, and it seems only peripherally related to the riots. So the death toll so far is limited to that one death and the two kids who died in a substation on October in a power substation in the suburb of Clichy-sous-Bois on October 27th. And the French government is very concerned that the death toll not rise. And I think it doesn't want to it doesn't want to worsen the situation by having the police fire live bullets.
Again, John Carreyrou is reporting to us from Paris, where he works for The Wall Street Journal. Is the 50% unemployment of young people, second and third generation immigrants, is said to be a lot of the reason for this? How much of it is also related to the failure in France to assimilate Muslims and Arabs?
You're right. Those two things are at the root of the problem, and in fact, they're related. France has a very big North African population, overwhelmingly Muslim. It represents about these days 9 to 10% of the total population of France. So we're talking about anywhere from 5 to 6 million people, and these are first generation and second generation immigrants from North Africa who've not been integrated. The French philosophy of integration is basically assimilation. If you come to France, you become French and you shed your culture and language of origin. That has not happened with these communities, and these communities are being penalized as a result, and there is de facto segregation, and integration has been a complete failure. As you said, unemployment is a huge problem in these banlieues, as the poor immigrant suburbs of Paris and other big cities are called. The unemployment rates reach 40-50% in some of these banlieues among the North African youth aged 14 to 30. And amid this unemployment, there's crime, there's delinquency, there's drug dealing, and there's a lot of despair. And all that is finding expression in the rioting of the past 12 days.
John, just a few seconds left, but I gather at least one Muslim group has issued a fatwa against the rioting. Others are working with the French. Does there appear to be organized efforts to create violence as well as to stop it?
No, certainly no Islamic organization has been involved in stirring this violence. And if anything, they've been trying to play a mediating role, as we wrote today in the front page of the Wall Street Journal, a pacifying role. But in the long term, a lot of people here are suspicious that this mediating role is going to have the effect of strengthening these organizations, and that the state is going to be increasingly dependent on them to pacify and to control these poor immigrant suburbs. The reaction to what the Muslim groups are doing is very uneven.
Okay. John Carreyrou, once again with The Wall Street Journal in Paris, thank you so much for joining us today. In a moment, is Dick Cheney losing his clout on To The Point?
To The Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, I'll be back with To The Point. In Baghdad today, 5 U.S. soldiers have been charged with allegedly abusing detainees. The detainees were allegedly punched and kicked while they were awaiting movement to a detention facility. That incident happened on September 7th. Meantime, in Panama City, President Bush vigorously defended U.S. interrogation practices in the war on terror.
We are finding terrorists and bringing them to justice. We are gathering information about where the terrorists may be hiding. We are trying to disrupt their plots and plans. Anything we do to that effort, to that end, in this effort, any activity we conduct is within the law. We do not torture.
Again, the president speaking today in Panama City. This comes as newspapers and magazines are reporting that Vice President Dick Cheney faces some tough times in the Bush administration. Today's Washington Post reports on high-level resistance to Cheney's hard line on the treatment of terrorist suspects. Charles Babington contributed to the story. And Charles, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
How do you, if reconcile is the right word, your report today about Mr. Cheney's difficulty over this issue and what the president said in Panama?
Well, Vice President Cheney has said all along that we do not torture prisoners, although what he is trying to win is the freedom to treat prisoners as we want. So there might, you might decide there's a contradiction there. But I think what's happening is that all around the president, with some prominent officials, including Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, there's a growing concern that at least the image of the United States mistreating and possibly torturing prisoners is hurting us. It's detrimental to our foreign policy, and that's why you're seeing erosion of support sort of around Vice President Cheney, who's holding the hard line on this issue.
Now, this has been dramatized by the veto threat that the vice president apparently passed on to Senator McCain as he was organizing an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill, saying that there ought to be limits and that they ought to conform to the Geneva Conventions on the way that terrorist suspects are handled. That passed 90-9. And yet there's still a veto threat, I presume, hanging over it.
Yes, there is, Warren. And to try to be on the safe side, McCain has now put the same amendment on the Defense Authorization Bill, which is not quite the same as the Defense Appropriations Bill. So what he's trying to do is make sure that it has an avenue one way or another. But, you know, the larger picture here is really the fight for support really throughout the Congress, because in the House, the language hasn't passed there. The McCain language has not passed, but the feeling is that it has a majority of support, and so therefore the White House is fighting in both houses of Congress.
What about Secretary Rice? You mentioned that she has been among those who have apparently wanted to back away from this worldwide image of, I don't know what the word is, abusiveness, I guess.
That's right. She's, Secretary Rice has had a number of phone calls and meetings with the vice president and with others. And according to our report in the Post today, she has even interrupted trips to make sure that she checks in back home, if you will, to make sure that nothing is happening along this line while she's away. So you're right. Secretary Rice obviously feels that this image of mistreatment of prisoners is hurting the foreign policy of the United States more than it's helping, and that's why she's continually speaking up in opposition to the position that the vice president has taken.
You just told us that Senator McCain has added his amendment to yet a second bill having to do with defense appropriations. What do we hear from the Pentagon?
Well, the Pentagon, it's interesting there that there is a draft of a report from the Pentagon that would also place limits, as sort of an executive order about how to deal with prisoners. And when the vice president found out about that and the president, they tried to and have thus far held up its implementation. So you're seeing kind of bubbling up from a number of places throughout the bureaucracy, at high levels of the bureaucracy, concerns that one way or another sort of point the same way, that this policy is not helpful.
In the meantime, the CIA is much involved in all of this. The amendment of Senator McCain, Vice President Cheney asked Senator McCain to exempt the CIA from the requirements if, in fact, they were going to be passed. McCain refused to do that. But what's the significance of that, given your paper's report on the CIA's secret prisons in Eastern Europe?
Right. Warren, that was an excellent story by my colleague Dana Priest about these sort of off-the-books, if you will, sites in Eastern Europe and elsewhere where the CIA does interrogate terrorist suspects. And obviously the implication there is, well, now that those are known to exist, what the vice president would like to do, if he can't kill the McCain amendment outright, to try to carve out an exemption for the CIA. So presumably, if the amendment passed, it would still apply to the Defense Department, but not to the CIA. Now, of course, McCain is equally opposed to that, as are, I think, most of his supporters. So I'm not sure that will get any more traction than with the overall, repealing or rejection of the amendment.
And this is interesting in the context of Scooter Libby, the vice president's former chief of staff, and the vice president's evident contempt in the past for the CIA and its intelligence gathering capabilities. The vice president seems to be on the CIA's side on this one.
I guess that's true. It's hard to know what the CIA thinks, and obviously they're not speaking out, saying anything for the record. But I suppose since they are operating these camps that Dana Priest wrote about, that you could draw that conclusion. Yes.
And finally, Senator McCain, Senator Hagel, and others have been openly critical of the vice president in this regard. What about the broader issue that the Washington Post and others are reporting as well, that the vice president may at the moment be losing his clout?
Well, I guess one thing to keep in mind, Warren, is that the Constitution gives the vice president no duties except to be ready in case the president dies. And so his duties really are whatever the president chooses them to be. And, of course, in this case, President Bush has relied on Dick Cheney very heavily and made him probably the most prominent vice president in the country's history. And so the key really to his strength is, more than anything else, is his relationship with the president. As far as we know, there's been no, you know, diminution there. But obviously, these are not good times for this White House at this point, and the indictment of Scooter Libby is not helpful. And maybe what you are seeing, as we talked about earlier, that Condoleezza Rice and others sort of chipping away, at least on the prison treatment issue, is a sign that it's a tougher time than usual for the vice president.
What about the very conservative Republicans on this issue of the treatment of prisoners? Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania, Sam Brownback of Kansas, how do they come down on this?
I'm not familiar with all their positions in detail, but they, you know, there is a concern, I think, really across the Republican spectrum, let alone the Democratic spectrum, that that we're getting a black eye in this country, and that you know, with all the difficulties that we have, you know, prosecuting the war in Iraq, that the continued bad publicity about treatment of prisoners is probably something that is in many people's minds doing more harm than good, and maybe it's time to move to a different policy.
Charles Babington, thanks again very much for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
Congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. Dr. Eli Krakowski is senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. He formerly was special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense during both of the Reagan administrations. He's now a private consultant in addition to his work for the American Foreign Policy Council. And Dr. Krakowski, thank you for joining us once again.
Pleasure.
We've heard that from all directions, including the Office of the Secretary of State, there seems to be this concern about America getting a black eye in this regard. Is it worth it?
Hello?
Yes.
Is it what?
Is it worth it to have this image about America overseas having to do with the rules for the treatment of prisoners in the war on terror?
I'm not sure that you know it's, whether it's worth it or not worth it. What I find very interesting is the amount of attention and obsession with image, and how little the attention there is to the substance of policy, to the stakes involved, and to the objectives to be attained. We are in a very major struggle where the enemy feels no limits and no bounds, where they decapitate people, drag corpses in public, and the amount of concern for that, I think, is unbelievably limited, whereas there is an enormous amount of attention to our image and what we do. When you look at what is actually being done and what people are saying, I just wonder why people are seem to be so concerned with the issue of torture. The United States is behaving better than any other country. I think I've been on your show before in discussing the issue of torture.
You have indeed.
And the repeated claims that terrorists are somehow subject to the Geneva Convention, I think, has no merit or very little. But aside from that, I certainly don't condone torture, and I don't think that what we are talking about is torture. It is simply the issue of being able to put pressure on prisoners so that they will talk, and with the objective, very often, of saving lives of American personnel who are put at risk for the freedom of others. So I think that, you know, and when you talk about recent stories of soldiers being arrested for manhandling prisoners, while this may not be the thing to do, I certainly don't think that this is torture. And I certainly think that torture itself is most often counterproductive. So the question is not that. It is a question of not behaving towards them as though they are regular people arrested within the American system and having to read them Miranda rights.
You said earlier that we face an enemy that has no limits and maintains no bounds, that decapitates and drugs corpses through the streets and so on. Senator McCain says this argument is not about them, but about us, and that it's imperative for us to maintain the standards of the Geneva Conventions and the UN Convention Against Torture, regardless of what the enemy does. What do you say to that?
I certainly don't mean to imply that we should be behaving the way the enemy does. Far from that. And I think that the issue of the argument, as I say, is way out of proportion to what is actually occurring. And I think also that with regard to McCain and the guidelines, I'm not so sure that these things are necessary. Certainly, we already know that Al-Qaeda tells its people that they should be entitled to claim their rights, that they don't have to respond to questions, things like that. And when you issue regulations which ultimately become public, it is then very easy for the enemy to basically get around everything and deny the United States the ability to wage the war.
Military people particularly, some CIA people as well, are saying that if we have the reputation for not extending rights and privileges to prisoners, then the same treatment will be, or then that the enemy then will treat our prisoners worse than it might otherwise do, and that there is a counterbalance, a sort of backlash, if you have the image of not maintaining the Geneva Conventions and so on. Is that an argument then in the other direction?
I don't think so, because first of all, the first thing that this does is equate American behavior to that of the terrorists. And as I said before, it is extreme. They are tremendous, such differences that one cannot even compare them. Second, I think that you have seen already ample evidence of the treatment accorded to the United States, to Americans who have been captured. So I don't see how that is an argument. It's this whole thing to me has the aura of an internal debate among some Americans, totally devoid of contact with the reality of the outside world.
Dr. Eli Karkowski, once again, a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council, formerly with the Reagan administration in the Defense Department. I want to introduce our next guest, then we'll have to go to a break very shortly after that. So, Ray McGovern, I'll let you sort of make a topic, a sentence here, if you will, and then we'll come back to you after our break. But Ray McGovern is an analyst, or was an analyst, I should say, at the CIA for 27 years. He's co-founder of an organization called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which has been very critical of the administration and its use of intelligence, and we're glad to have you back on our program as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
First, the exemption that the vice president is asking for has to do with these authorities, these institutions being run allegedly by the CIA. In your first 30 seconds, that's how long we have till we go to the break, what about those CIA institutions?
Well, these were authorities that were given the CIA by the President of the United States. It is the law of this land that the President can use the CIA in such manner. The only restraint on him is the Congress and the oversight committees, and they have not been doing their job for the last 4 years. So it's not quite right to blame the CIA for this, even though I certainly would not cooperate in this kind of torture. You need to lay the blame or the responsibility, the accountability, which is a word lost in Washington these days, with the President of the United States and
right.
The Vice President.
All right. You used the word torture. Dr. Karkowski says that's not what's going on. Major part of the argument. We will return to it in a moment. Talk also about executive authority on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, to talking today about the treatment of prisoners in the War on Terror and America's image. In a moment, we'll get to the broader question of executive authority as exercised in particular by the Vice President Cheney, thought to be the most most powerful vice president in recent history. That, of course, by virtue, as Charles Babington just pointed out, of the authority given him by the president, inasmuch as the Constitution only requires that he preside over the Senate and break ties if necessary and be available to replace the president, should that be required. Ray McGovern, again, analyst at the CIA for 27 years and co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. As you just said, the president has given the CIA the authority to run what appear to be secret prisons in various countries around the world, and this question arises about what should be the limits on the CIA and others in the treatment of prisoners. What do you say to what Dr. Krakowski said a moment ago, that we're spending too much time on this, that the United States behaves much better, certainly, than the terrorist enemy does in this regard, and that the more we talk about it, the more counterproductive and endangering to Americans overseas it becomes?
Yeah. Well, I was talking to an old friend of mine who was a general during the Vietnam days. I asked him about all this. He shook his head and he said, "Ray, I thought we were different. You know, I really thought we were different." The suggestion that this debate has nothing to do with the outside world really bothers me. I was an Army officer in infantry and intelligence. We had to memorize that field manual. We knew exactly what the constraints were on how we would treat prisoners of war and how we would be treated were we to be captured. And to see this just shoved aside and left by the wayside in favor of ambiguous rules that say you can torture, quote, as appropriate and as consistent with military necessity, end quote, which is in the order dated February 7 of 2002 that the President of the United States signed. I have it before me. You can download it from the web. A loophole that you can drive a truck through, and that's how you get Abu Ghraib, and that's how you get all these other. You know, this is not just cruel and inhuman punishment. There are a number of people who have been killed in our custody. I think the number is now in the 30s or 40s, and there are procedural efforts, there are judicial efforts against the captors, the MPs, and the interrogators for having people die under quote, interrogation, end quote. So this is a very, very important thing. It cuts to who we are as a nation, whether we're different from Osama bin Laden or whether we're the same.
What do you say to Dr. Krakowski's contention that the Geneva Conventions don't apply to terrorists? I believe it's argued in the Attorney General's memo, which came out of the Vice President's office, apparently, and in other places as well, that they are not an enemy in the standard sense. They don't represent a country. They're not in uniform. Mm-hmm. They're not consequently subjected to the same rules that others are, and they certainly don't act accordingly.
Yes, that's a very good question. Now, David Addington, who now has replaced Irv Liddy as the chief of staff to the vice president, he is acknowledged to be the author of that famous memorandum dated January 25, 2002, which said, in effect, the Geneva Conventions are quaint and obsolete, and this is a direct quote. Mr. President, we believe that there is, quote, a reasonable basis in law, end quote, where you can exclude whole categories of people like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and still have a prospect of avoiding prosecution should in the future some mean-spirited special prosecutor proceed against you under not only the Geneva Conventions, but under the War Crimes Act, U.S. Criminal Code, 1996. This is written in black and white. You can download that from the web, too. It sounded like a mafia lawyer trying to explain what people might get away with. And that was February. That was January 25, 2002. Just a week later, or 10 days later, the president issued his order, and that was what set in train the ambiguities that were attached and that Rumsfeld used and the generals used to, as famously was said, take the gloves off. The gloves came off after 9/11, and we were able to do, or actually encouraged to do, quote, what is necessary to interrogate folks. Now, I'd just like to say just one more thing. Two reasons have been adduced to explain why torture should not be used. One is the famous image problem, and I can appreciate that as a foreign affairs analyst. The other that has been mentioned has been endangering our own troops, and as an infantry officer, I can certainly identify with that. But those are the two least important of five reasons why torture is wrong. The third is it brutalizes the brutalizer. Our troops that are being encouraged to do this come home brutalized, and I, as a father and a grandfather, I can identify with that. The next thing is, next in importance up toward the top, is it doesn't work. I'm an intelligence professional. I spent 27 years in the CIA, and I know that the information extracted under torture can never be considered reliable. And last but not least, my goodness, it's just plain wrong. I'm a product of mainstream ethics and morality in this country, not only the Judeo-Christian kind of morality, but I asked a Muslim colleague of mine, what does the Quran say about torture? And she consulted her imam and came back and she said, you know, the Quran doesn't say anything about torture because the Quran concerns itself solely with human activity.
Ray McGovern, analyst at the CIA for 27 years, now with Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Let me go back to Dr. Ellie Krakowski, again, formerly with the Reagan administration, now at the American Foreign Policy Council. You said yourself that you don't think that torture works. So what are we talking about here? And why is it that there can't be the kinds of limits that Senator McCain wants to put in the law having to do with the field manual that Ray McGovern says when he was a soldier he had to memorize?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that what one can react, because in the kind of things that were said before, I think there is a lot of innuendo and references to mafia in order to paint people who are very professional and doing the job, and in essence said when you take off all the innuendos and disparaging comments and remarks about people who disagree, when you come down to the bottom line, is that in fact what we are talking about is that there have been instances of abuses. That nobody has said that the laws of war, the field manual, does not apply. Nobody has said that the Geneva Conventions are obsolete. People have said that they do not apply by law to terrorists and their supporters. And that, I think, remains a fact. It has nothing to do with the lack of validity or such of the Geneva Conventions. They remain as law.
But the question remains, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I understand what you're saying about innuendo and so on, but without necessarily responding to all of that, what about the point that the excess treatment brutalizes the brutalizer, doesn't work, as you said yourself, and is morally and ethically wrong? So what then are we talking about? What ought to be able to do that they can't do now?
What we are talking about is, I think, number one, that they should be able to put pressure on prisoners, and that this goes beyond, there are sometimes gray lines as to what is and what is not, going beyond what is acceptable. That is not always clear, but I think in general, American forces are very careful that the cases of abuse exist, and they probably exist in any system. They also exist even in very different circumstances in police departments, and when they are found, they are investigated, and the people responsible are punished, and that is how it should be. But what that one should start making very clear guidelines that go beyond what already exists, and is in fact telling the enemy, and this is the big point here, and that is that people who are captured should remain uncertain as to what will happen to them, and there shouldn't be the type of thing that you have when people are read their Miranda rights.
Okay,
I think that's what it is. It's not the issue of torture, and I don't think that whatever has been said says that the United States actually tortures people. There are exceptions that happen. There is no policy to torture people. There is no policy to abuse people, and I think that gets lost in the shuffle of all the noise about these things.
All right, Ray McGovern, I want to broaden this discussion out into the issue of executive power as wielded particularly by the current vice president. But let me just ask you to respond to what we have heard, and if you can, only that point.
Sure.
Should the people who we capture in the war on terror be uncertain? What, for example, and this is always used as the classic case, you have reason to believe they know that somebody's going to release a nuclear weapon in an American city, and they're the only one that knows, and you could perhaps save millions of lives if you could find out what they do know.
Yeah. Well, that's the example always adduced to justify this kind of torture. It doesn't work out that way. You're never quite sure. This is a theoretical example that never obtains in reality.
But what about the uncertainty principle for those who are captured and the notion that they ought to expect that or anticipate or be afraid and that they consequently might be more likely to give information that's important?
Well, I've known lots of POWs, and they are ipso facto afraid. There's no need to create additional ambiguity as to what's going to happen to them. It's just really not very necessary to create additional uncertainty. When you're captured, you're afraid ipso facto. Let me just address the Geneva Convention.
Quickly, if you will, because we've got to move on.
There's no provision in the Geneva Conventions to exempt anyone from Geneva protections, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, anyone else. There is a provision that you can do this multilaterally. You cannot unilaterally simply exclude classes of people as the president did. And he did that on the advice of this David Addington and Gonzalez. And he did that because the CIA was asked to torture, and the CIA came back and said, well, Mr. President, if you want us to do this, you need to sign this memo. And that is the genesis of this whole business. He signed the memo, and torture was off and running.
Very quickly, Dr. Kukowski, your response on that one single point. Is that the way you understand the Geneva Conventions and the sequence of events?
Not at all, and I'm not sure what is being referred to. The Geneva Convention applies to people wearing a uniform, easily recognizable insignia, reporting through a chain of command to officers that themselves are responsible to a legitimate government. None of these conditions apply to the Al-Qaeda or the Taliban.
Okay. Obviously, there's room for enormous disagreement on all of these points, and we will have to have a further discussion of them on future programs, because we do want to get to this other broader issue involving the vice president. Andrew Rodilevich is author of The New Imperial Presidency, Renewing Presidential Power After Watergate. He's an associate professor of political science at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. Professor, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We heard at the very early part of our program Charles Babington of the Washington Post say, as have other reporters, Newsweek, Time, and others, that the vice president now is getting questions from within the Bush administration itself and from the Congress as well as to the exercise of executive power. Tell us a bit about the role of the current vice president in the expansion of the role of executive power, how that fits into the history of this issue.
Well, as Mr. Babington said, the vice president doesn't exercise authority that's not flowing to him from the president himself. But that said, Mr. Cheney has obviously been a very important advisor to President Bush, and the vice president, going back to his days as a staffer in the Nixon and Ford White Houses, has been a very consistent and strong proponent of unilateral executive authority. When he was Secretary of Defense, for example, under the first President Bush, he argued that congressional authorization was not necessary for the first Gulf War. Before that, even as a member of Congress himself, he had suggested that the presidency was being encroached upon. And that philosophy, when he became vice president, was very much front and center. Many people in the Bush administration, but perhaps most explicitly Vice President Cheney, have argued that the 35 years after Watergate represented an encroachment by the legislature on the executive, and that the Bush administration was dedicated to rolling that back.
What's the argument that is posed against that idea that we obviously would be based, of course, on the separation of powers in the Constitution?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, there's certainly an argument for presidential power, and the more complex the government becomes and the larger the crisis that is ensuing, the more of a practical argument certainly you can make for relying on a president who is, after all, structurally unified, very different than a very divided and often chaotic Congress. That said, James Madison and other folks who were instrumental in drafting the Constitution saw tyranny of any form as something that needed to be resisted structurally within the government. And so, for example, in the Federalist Papers, Madison wrote about the idea of ambition counteracting ambition. He expected presidents to push, right, and to try to expand their authority. He also expected legislators to push back. We did see that immediately after the Vietnam War and Watergate. But over the last 30 years, I would read the history a little bit differently. Over that time, presidents have reasserted their authority, and Congress, as was mentioned earlier, has really not been very aggressive in defending its own prerogatives.
Does that have something to do with the fact that the president and the current Congress are of the same party?
It has something to do with it, but on the other hand, this was true under President Clinton. It was true under the first President Bush.
They tried to impeach President Clinton.
Well, certainly, but at the same time, he was able to use unilateral authority to, for example, shoot off cruise missiles various places around the world, even while impeachment was swirling on the House floor. He was able to use his structural authority within the executive branch to issue signing statements and administrative orders that reshaped the way the policies were implemented. So even presidents who seem politically weak have this reservoir of structural power. That can certainly be added to by a sympathetic Congress. But I don't think it's just a matter of partisan sympathy here. I think there's also a tendency in Congress not to rock the boat. They don't see a political advantage to getting involved in these battles, and they've been perfectly willing to let the president take the lead. I'm not sure that's healthy for our debate or our democracy, but that, I think, has been the case.
Well, now we have on this very conspicuous issue, although Dr. Kukowski says he thinks it's too conspicuous, nonetheless it is, we have Senator McCain, Senator Hagel, and others reportedly as well, and in the Congress as well as the Senate, nervous about this issue of image and the way that prisoners are treated. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's liable to weaken the vice president in other ways that will have the impact then of weakening executive authority vis-a-vis the Congress?
Well, the claims that have been made by the administration and certainly forwarded by the vice president's office in this current debate are very broad, to the extent that perhaps if you read the most sweeping of them, that the administration has claimed that even were there legal prohibitions against the use of torture, for example, that those could not be upheld constitutionally if the president is ordering it in the capacity as commander-in-chief in wartime. So, again, I haven't seen anything to suggest that the vice president is losing his role as trusted advisor to the president, but certainly this becomes difficult politically, especially as the administration itself begins to splinter on these issues. You are seeing now what you might think of as ambition rising within the Congress. Senator McCain, of course, has been very vocal. And he, of course, is particular standing in this issue, given his history as a Vietnam veteran. But members of Congress have their own ambitions. The president does not have to run for office again, but these members do, and they're beginning to see swirlings in public opinion, I think, that make them willing to question the claims that are being made by the administration and by the vice president. The
president doesn't have to run for president again, and nonetheless, others want that office, mm-hmm. and it may well be that that will play a role. Perhaps it is already. We'll simply have to see. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Andrew Rudalevich at Dickinson College in Carlisle, author of The New Imperial Presidency. Sorry we don't have more time. We'll have you back on another program. Thanks again for
being with
us.
Thanks very much.
Thanks also to Ray McGovern, analyst at the CIA, now with Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and Dr. Ellie Krakowski at the American Foreign Policy Council, as well as Charles Babington, the congressional correspondent for the Washington Post. We'll talk about those issues on other programs as well. I want to go back now to Sunday, October 31st of 2004, when the Reverend George Regas addressed the All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, one of Southern California's most liberal churches. He said this, that good people of profound faith could vote for either George Bush or John Kerry. But he told the congregation that Jesus would have opposed the war in Iraq. Now the Internal Revenue Service says the church may lose its tax-exempt status. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Manali back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena may lose its tax-exempt status because of that anti-war sermon just 2 days before the presidential election. A letter received by the church says the federal tax code prohibits tax-exempt organizations, including churches, from intervening in political campaigns and elections. Now, that letter was received back in June. It was just reported today in the Los Angeles Times. Alan Wolf is director of the Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. Professor, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren.
You surprised by this?
It seems like an unusual move. Churches have always been allowed and permitted in this country to be prophetic, to talk about issues of transcendental importance, including issues of social justice. They've also not been permitted to endorse candidates or to get directly involved in politics. This seems to me to have been more on the prophetic end than the political end. In that sense, I think it's a bit unusual.
So I guess you think it would take the edge off the politics if, in a sermon opposing the war and saying that Jesus would oppose the war, the Reverend apparently also said that good people of profound faith could vote for either man. Is that sort of the saving phrase there?
I think absolutely. I mean, these distinctions are very hard to draw. And I'm not talking about, as a lawyer, I'm talking about, you know, as someone who thinks about these issues morally and philosophically. But, yeah, if you leave the impression that one party is embodies your religious values and the other party is atheistic and does not, that's pretty explicitly political. If you condemn both parties, in that sense, it's much more in the prophetic tradition. And, by the way, we have plenty of examples of the much more political ones that have not received IRS letters.
I want to talk about that in a second. Before we do, though, one more point about the church in Pasadena. The current rector of the church, Edwin Bacon, says one of the strongest sermons he ever gave was against President Clinton's fraying, as he put it, of the social safety net. So apparently this church has been going, has had its criticism of the Democrats as well as the Republicans.
I think so. I mean, All Saints is well known as, quote unquote, a liberal church. But I see it as much more that a church that speaks for its interpretation of what Jesus would do in the contemporary world.
Professor Alan Wolf, director of the Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. Well, what about these churches that you just mentioned who we don't, as far as we know, that have not, as far as we know, received letters like this?
Well, there are plenty of examples. In the 2004 election, a few Catholic bishops denounced pro-choice Democrats, while not saying a word about pro-choice Republicans. In fact, the Republican convention was dominated by Rudy Giuliani and Arnold Schwarzenegger and George Pataki, all of whom are pro-choice, just like John Kerry. Now, when you denounce one party and not the other, that's really there's no prophecy there. But they, as we say, they didn't get any such letters. And of
well,
course,
a Catholic bishop, though, per se, wouldn't be entitled to tax exemption, though.
Well, no, but, you know, then there are plenty of examples from the Protestant world as well of Baptist churches and the Southern Baptist Convention generally being fairly explicit in its participation in politics.
How explicit? What's the record there as far as direct involvement with candidates are concerned?
Well, there's you'll get a kind of wink and nod approach, where the pastor will say, now, I'm not allowed by the IRS to endorse any candidate, but when I speak about homosexuality or family values, you know who I mean. You know, or there is the example of Ronald Reagan, who said, you can't endorse me, but I endorse you. So there are plenty of examples like that. Many conservative and predominantly white evangelical and conservative Christian churches will point out that black ministers in the inner city are pretty explicit in their identification with the Democratic Party. And in truth, there is some truth with that claim.
Some truth dating from the civil rights movement, certainly, but even before that.
No, absolutely. Although, you know, Martin Luther King himself, again, was not a Democrat. He spoke in a prophetic sense rather than in a political sense.
What does it do to a church, do you think, to become political in this sense, to speak out on social issues? You said that involvement in those social issues was certainly part of our political tradition. But again, we're talking here about the separation of church and state and tax exemption and so on. Sure. What are the consequences of all this?
Well, we have separation of church and state, but we don't have separation of church and culture. And churches are perfectly appropriate to speak to the larger issues involving the culture. If they become too close to politics, however, if they become too partisan, they really undermine their prophetic role. They lose their status as religious organizations. They become just like any other political organization. For example, I would expect that given what the IRS has done here in Pasadena to All Saints, that we'd have letters from the religious right condemning this, because these are churches that also, the conservative churches, want to speak out on these issues. If they do that, all the more power to them. But my guess is they won't, because they're so political, they're so closely tied to the Republican Party, that they'll forego this opportunity. And that's an example of the kind of hypocrisy that follows when a church becomes much more political than prophetic.
Is that true in the other direction? Are there liberal, democratic-leaning churches that might be guilty of hypocrisy as well?
I think there are. There certainly are liberal churches that see their role as fairly close to what the Democratic Party does. And if they criticize the Democratic Party, it's from the left of the party. In other words, it's maintaining a kind of leftism. It works on both sides of the issue. But the fact is that most of the blame in our society right now does involve the right. These are the most explicitly partisan and the most engaged kind of churches. And that's why I'd like to see them come to the defense of Edwin Bacon at All Saints.
Are there people who say that, or are there not people who say, I know there are, that that we ought not to have tax exemption for churches or anybody else?
Well, you know, that would solve the problem. Then you don't have to worry about any of these things. And indeed, you know, you sometimes, well, isn't this what churches themselves should want to do? After all, tax exemption gives them a benefit in the world around us, but churches speak to another world, a higher world, and maybe they should forego the tax exemption so that they can speak, you know, in any way they want. I look forward to seeing how many churches will come along and say, no, we voluntarily give up our tax exemption because we have higher matters. Or to put it another way, Jesus wouldn't want a tax exemption.
All right. Jesus didn't like the war, according to the sermon at the Liberal All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, a letter from the IRS saying it may have gotten too political. We'll follow this one and see what happens next, just reported today in the Los Angeles Times. Professor Wolf, thanks a lot for being
with
us.
Thank you, Warren.
With the Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College, author of Moral Freedom and One Nation After All. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton and Karen Radziner, with Sharon Rembaum, Christian Bordahl, and Jonah King. Technical Director Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.